Welcome to Cybersecurity Where You Are, the Center for Internet Security's podcast. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO at CIS.
And I'm Tony Sager, Senior Vice President and Chief Evangelist at CIS. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we're online at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or running a state or local government.
So join us on Wednesdays as we discuss trends and threats, explore security best practices, and interview experts in the industry.
Together, we'll clarify these issues, creating confidence in the connected world.
Hello, and welcome to the show, Cybersecurity Where You Are. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO here at the Center for Internet Security, joined by the host with the most, the difference maker, the Hall of Famer, Mr. Tony Sager. How are you, Tony?
Hey, Sean. Great to be back with you.
Absolutely. Now, we're back for part two, Tony, on the 12 CIS expert cybersecurity predictions for 2025. So in our first session, we got through six. We're going to hit the final six here. And well, we'll see if we can get through. Maybe we'll do three and we'll have a part three. But but we'll start from here. So where we move into, where we jump into is Lee Myers. He's our Senior Director of Security Operations. Vast years of experience. And you can see where he's thinking strategically and tactically with his thought here. So he's looking at the consolidation of operations. He's saying, instead of buying the next greatest element in technology to add to the fog, I owe you more money again, to the fog of more, Tony, he's saying what organizations now need to do is understand that footprint, inventory what's in-house, and maximize the return on investment of what you have today before adding net new. One, really a reduction in the redundancy of these tools that potentially sit in the data center, on the shelf, you know, behind a tile on a screen. Really looking at that impact. Get those tools working for you, maximizing the value, getting that return on investment. I think it's so important, and the way he thinks and strategically thinking is, where do we see need for investment over time? Completely get. But we're not starting from square one. We have security capability within an organization. We've got to maximize that. And really, organizations, and his prediction, looking at organizations addressing, understanding their security posture and utilizing what exists. And Tony, we see it. I mean, you know, we've been to RSA. You know, we walk the floor of the what I call Las Vegas in San Francisco for cybersecurity. And there's a plethora, right? There's always a new tool, a new capability, something new and exciting. If it's not AI, it's not working. And with that, I get that, you know, there's new extended capability, but there's also a need to address fundamental cyber hygiene practices that currently exist within an environment. And being able to augment that, I think so important. And I appreciate Lee's perspective on that.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, Sean. I mean, you know, and I was part of the stand up of a number of the big operational early cyber watch operations kinds of things back at the National Security Agency. And, you know, one of the things that struck me even in those days, and I think a lot of it's still true today, was the incredible volume of grunt work that's involved, the data moving, formatting, correlating, integrating. It's just an incredible pile. And it's really hard to make sense of it. You know, one of our strategic, mistakes we have made as an industry, we've let humans become the primary integration engine for a lot of technology. You know, and so the nature of the market is, you know, it's a new thing here and a new thing there, but it always comes down to the ability of humans to make sense of it. And so, you know, without a better model, you get this massive pile of stuff that we ask humans to be the primary analytic engine. I mean, okay, now we can talk about AI, right? Because that's where we need some of this grunt work taken off the table. And I think this visibility thing that you mentioned, you know, when I first started speaking in public, though, much to my surprise, right? I was always the guy who found flaws, never the person who had to fix them like folks like you. And people would ask me this question. It was kind of embarrassing because I didn't have a good answer. It was, what would you do first? And I would say, oh, look at all this great NIST documentation, NSA release. Yeah, but I can't read all that at once. My boss has a limited attention span. I have a tiny budget. What do we do first? And my immediate answer, this popped into my head, was visibility. And exactly what you were saying, right? This visibility of my assets, what state are they in? Am I comfortable with that? What has changed is one of the foundational elements of defense. And it's not just sort of good stuff to do. Now, I grew up in a place that was an intelligence agency that attacked other people for a living. And what they took advantage of was lack of visibility by the defense. That is, you're hiding in the noise. They can't update quickly enough. You know, you get to understand their topology better than the defenders do. It's really a tremendous opportunity for bad guys. The complexity, the noise, the volume of garbage that floats around. So I think you're right on the money there. At least points are well taken. And the other is, I used to run this, I don't know if I ever ran this thought question by you, but I kept hearing vendors say it, vendors to the DOD and NSA at the time. And they all had kind of a similar answer. I said, because I heard a couple of them say this, oh, our customer only uses X percent of what we sold them. And so I would ask that question of everyone, what percentage? Well, the number, strikingly, was always something like 40%. And it was amazing how consistent it was, you know, 40, 50, maybe a 60 or whatever. But the point was, there was more capability in the tools that had been purchased. And there was frustration on the salespeople part because they wanted to optimize, right, the use of their product and crowd out competitors. But it was also this, it told you something about the challenge of defenders to optimize what they already have. And so and I get it, defense is really hard work. So we're always hoping for a better way. And so there's a temptation, right, for the newest, shiniest, you know, most dramatic solution possible. But you know, again, that creates more of that fog. More data does not equal more knowledge. It means just more data. And if you don't manage it, plan it and have a plan for it. So this idea, you know, the thing that Lee pointed out around consolidation, integration is right on the money, right? We cannot ask humans to scale up anymore in terms of the volume of data, the ability to make correlation, the ability to draw conclusions. That's the role of technology. And humans have proven pretty resilient, right? From the earliest, you know, days of the cuckoo's egg and, you know, things that you've read in history, you young whippersnapper, you. You know, humans have this unique ability to do pattern matching, spot anomalies, you know, sort of determinedly correlate things, but also track things, right, based upon some intuition that I don't think we've figured out how to recreate with technology yet. So, hey, don't worry, humans, there'll be work for us, you know, in the foreseeable future. But I think Lee's point is well taken. Now, is it happening right at this moment? No, there's a lot of things going on still being sorted out about, you know, visibility, the use of better technology to help make sense of it. But I think this is a great area for us to kind of reexamine some foundational things and look at this problem of information overload. And, you know, I got to live it every day back in my prior career. And, you know, we get to live it, you know, here at CIS, given the scope of the nationwide mission that we have for state and local governments.
Absolutely. So now move on to next, another Lee, Lee Noriega, Executive Director of Cybersecurity Services Organization, CSO. Now, he's very much focused on the AI piece. And we talked in part one, Tony, about AI. But he's looking at AI really as an attack vector in terms of cyber criminals utilizing it, one, as a utility, a tool, phishing generation, ransomware evolution, and really then starting to assess the potency in terms of generative AI. It's used in sophisticated scams, impersonation, and then the utility not only of AI from the attack vector perspective, but AI integrated into business operations. And we've seen a plethora of that. So Lee hit that one right on the head there. But it's also looking at improper use of the tools as well, creating a governance of AI. So, so important in terms of, well, the data's gone into the model now. Where's the model? Who owns the data that's generated from it? And who takes ownership of the data that was put into it? All questions that need to be considered. Specifically, in an age, Tony, where I'm thinking of privacy in the space and the utility of certain data, intellectual property, all of this has value. And you mentioned that, you know, there's a treasure trove of insight that we can gain from that data. but we have to do it judiciously. It can't just be, oh, we'll ask AI to fix that for us, or we'll ask a generative capability to, you know, give me a predictive model of the best-selling strategy for all of these customers. And, well, here's their addresses, and here's all their PII, and will that help? You know, can we use those as features in the data set? We've got to be so careful about how we use and integrate AI into our capability and its judicious use. I mean, ultimately, Tony, that's where it leaves us. It's both a great responsibility as well as a burden in some cases.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Sean, in the role that you have, it's a CISO for a security company. I mean, this is everyday stuff for you. You're managing issues of privacy, data, governance, and all those kinds of things. And I think, I'll cartoon it a bit. I mean, I think the history of the business, how do we get trust in systems? And I'll cartoon it. This is the way I often talk about it. We do it through a combination of control and inspection. That is, we have control over, for example, who gets to create data, modify data, access data, et cetera. And we also, that's a mix of technical things, process things, governance, training, et cetera. But also inspection, that is, we can go back to look. So inspecting of things like logs, inspecting of processes, right? Inspecting of the data, the artifacts of software development, right? To give us trust that the software behaves in a certain way. And, you know, control, and one of the classic dilemmas of security is that vis-a-vis mainstream IT, a lot of the evolution of IT is designed to hide details from us. I don't have to worry about where my data is stored because, you know, I don't want to. Right? I don't want to worry about the physical parts and which disk, and, you know, which sector. I want to deal with the data. So you build more abstraction into your IT, which makes the challenge of control and inspection much harder. Where is your data? Has it been controlled at every step of the way? Who knows? It's being maneuvered through all kinds of bits of technology and through caches. And, you know, so by design, you're abstracting out complexity or details. And yet our traditional way of thinking about security is about control, understanding the details, you know, both technically and process wise. And I think you're right to Lee's point is the two-edged part of this. And it's inevitably true in security, right? The bad guys, I always say, if you want to study capitalism, you don't study good guys, you study bad guys, because they're looking for efficiency, they're looking for specialization, they're looking for the cheap, you know, I don't want to do reconnaissance, I just want to pay for it. I don't want to build a botnet, I want to rent time. You know, they're sort of naturally driven that way because their objectives are clear. And it's a bit of a Darwinian, you know, infrastructure, right? Who can provide me the best service cheaper? Boy, doesn't that sound like capitalism? The poor good guys are dealing with everything from governance, oversight, you know, legal issues, funding issues. They have to deal in a more whole and complicated world. And so it inevitably makes it much more challenging. And so you have to expect a level of agility on the attack side. And so who adopts early technology or who adopts new technology early? It's usually bad guys. Because they're looking for scale, they're looking for those kind of cost advantages, and they're unhindered by lots of the things that, you know, folks like you have to worry about, in a given day. But I think that point. So if you look at them, yeah, there's clearly, the attackers look at this kind of technology because it makes them better at what they do, and it's clearer that it helps them achieve their objectives. The business operations side, though, again, as we both talked about before, there is so much work and complexity and redundancy and, you know, just data cloud dealing with in defense, that there's great opportunities for improvement to take humans out of that sort of frontline dealing with that, you know, the details and more in the thinking about what, have we actually implement the good intentions of these policies or this governance that we have to deal with or these frameworks that we have to report to. You know, you want brain power folks like you really focused on a more strategic level here, and some of the details can be managed by technology better. I'd say we're a little behind in that, that area right now. The excitement is, you know, markets are like that. And if you ever heard me use one of my phrases, Sean, never underestimate the power of cheap and easy.
Yes.
This is a technology statement. You know, the idea is why did LLMs take off so amazingly in the last couple of years, as opposed to, I mean, people have been working in AI and expert systems for decades, but it's the price and easy, right? Easy to use, accessible to anybody, download it, you know, run it from your PC. And what that does is it draws interest, it draws more investment money, it draws more opportunity to grow rapidly. And that's what we've seen play out here, you know, in the last few years. And it's very exciting, but security never leads. Security almost always follows, right? It's, wait a minute, what's wrong with you security people, John? You're holding us back. We need this capability. It's like, well, but we still have to obey the law. We still have to deal with frameworks. You know, we still have to preserve the reputation of our company employees and our customers. You know, all that is part of what that you have to deal with. So, but yeah, Lee and I often talk about these things. He's one of the few people that probably goes back about as far as I do, and, you know, kind of dealing with very low end machines and the early days of sort of commodity computing. And so, you know, it's great to get his perspective. And I think, again, I think he's got something to offer, and it's certainly worth reading, you know, what he put into our projections for this year.
Absolutely. Well, that's two down, four to go. Let's take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Happy 25 years, CIS. Back in 2000, a bunch of experts from government, academia, and private industry met at the Cosmos Club in DC.
Their mission was clear: help local communities, businesses, government, and critical infrastructure defend against cyber threats, regardless of budget or expertise.
CIS was born to fulfill that mission.
So, Tony, how have we done so far?
Well, let's take a look at the numbers. We detected and mitigated close to 320,000 cyber events protecting public and private sector organizations.
We also blocked over 3 trillion potential connections to known malicious, suspicious, or otherwise risky sites in defense of critical infrastructure.
In 2024 alone, our guides received 1.5 million downloads for their straightforward, actionable security guidance.
And let's not forget 150 episodes of Cybersecurity Where You Are.
Certainly unforgettable, of course not. And honestly, Sean, that's just the beginning.
Absolutely. It's been an incredible 25 years, and we're just getting started.
The future of cybersecurity is evolving fast, and so are we at CIS.
We may not have all the answers yet,
but we've got the right people, the right mission, and a global community behind us.
So here's to the next 25 years of innovation, collaboration, and impact.
Join us on the journey at cisecurity.org.
Okay, welcome back. Now, Tony, the next gentleman is nearly on the show as much as me and you, Randy Rose.
okay, Randy. Yeah.
He has such a great perspective. Now, he's looking at 3 different areas. He was looking quantum, really now starting to apply quantum outside of research. So he's very much focused on what are we thinking about? And it really comes to mind is post-quantum cryptography. We've seen NIST take a very marked stance on the fact that this is required and, you know, doing their evaluations of certain algorithmic implementation and getting down, you know, working towards their recommendation. He also mentions the evolution of IoT and edge computing. He's seeing really attack surfaces grow. IoT just, you know, it's now part and practice. It's, you know, look in the room and if there's a cell phone in there, okay, IoT. If there's a, you know, a refrigerator nowadays, that's IoT. I mean, it's everywhere. And his final thought is very good. Again, you know, Randy's got a really unique way of looking at certain things. And he's mentioning the utility of AI and machine learning, but he's looking at socio-political impacts of that particular technology. I'm really now starting to assess where we're looking at generative AI really being used in everyday life, how it's a skill augmenter, how it's really starting to bring together challenges of authenticity, intellectual property, because these models have been trained on potentially elements, and we've seen in the news certain book repositories being used for training with certain models and things of that nature. Really, he's looking at that, how it's the digital divide in the space, maybe either supercharging our ability to consume information, but it's also the trust level. Is this supercharging disinformation in that space where we're starting to see these models potentially either being biased, the hallucination, or even poisoned in certain instances in that area? So he's covered a swath. I mean, we could probably take a series and to discuss all three of these elements, Tony. But again, he's always looking forward and has a great, unique view in this space as well.
Yeah, and then you're right about Randy. He's a, you know, one of the bigger thinkers in the team and always has something interesting to bring. Yeah, just, he didn't pick an easy and none of his topics was easy. The quantum stuff, I don't have much to add to. I think, when I was back at the fort, I mean, it was, you know, quantum is going to be here 5 years from now. And that was true for every year of my last 10 years of my career. But, you know, there's certainly breakthroughs in the engineering part of it. And people have started to give much more serious thought to broader ranges of applications. I think, you know, I'm not following it day to day anymore, but I think there's clearly lots of concerns about especially on the crypto side, the infrastructure of the internet. But I also think that, you know, within range, that's going to be a manageable problem. And it's probably not a popular opinion, but I think it actually makes sense in terms of the time window and the ability of attackers to exploit. The IoT and edge thing, yeah, you know, this has been happening for a long time, right? Most of us can't, remember the old exercise, we'd try to count how many IP addresses essentially were in our home or how many computers we owned. I think most of us can't count anymore. There's just too many of them. They're hiding in every picture frames. And like you said, you know, my appliances are getting too doggone smart. And, you know, the attack surface is unbelievable. And, you know, we see it in, you know, the vulnerabilities found in commodity IT pieces like routers and things like that. I mean, these are like, you know, very regular occurrences now. And both speaks to the speed of the marketplace, but also the challenge of building secure systems, right? There are no secure systems. There's security, you know, most of the security props, security and insecurity are system effects. So you can build, you know, with the best of intentions, you know, high quality software-based systems, but it's hard to anticipate all the ways that things go wrong or all the ways that people use technology or could deliberately or inadvertently misuse it. And, you know, every model, I spent a fair amount of time thinking about mathematical modeling of security and risk, you know, during the 80s and 90s in particular. And, you know, from everything from nuclear weapons to consumer things to crypto. And, you know, models are great. We need them. But they're almost always wrong because the presence of active attackers, the attackers don't respect your models. So they better be pretty good. And it's very hard to understand all the implications of all the complexity, right? And the ways that things will interact. And so I think the best you can do is sort of build more transparency, right? What, you know, and you see things like S-bombs and, you know, those, think of those as, I think of them as transparency machinery. You know I can't build perfect things, but let me tell you about all the pieces that I used. And any one of those pieces might be flawed, but it may or may not be a problem depending on the context. But if I don't have visibility into how the software developed, what was the caliber of the people who did it, the kind of known flaws, have they been exploited or not? If I don't have that kind of picture, I can never make a rational risk decision about that. So making that stuff visible is really important. But let me finish with Randy's point on AI, and I think he did compliment the others who spoke about that. Yeah, there's technical issues, but it's the social and political ones that are really, I think Randy's right, are very interesting because, again, we think of things like trust in a particular way, and we have developed trust in a particular way, but things like authority. What is an authoritative source? How do I gather data? We were all trained in a particular way to do that, and this is all now turned on its head. And, you know, the technology is new enough, we don't understand all of the implications, the things we should trust, the things we can't trust, how did it reach a conclusion? You know, how is it placed? In some ways, I don't want to, this is not to downplay the value of the technology, but some days it feels like some of these generative AI things are almost like a parlor trick. It's like so, you know, clever, the things that pop up. You're like, oh my gosh, it must be right. But it may or may not be right. And we haven't learned how do I develop trust in that, right? How does that? And for those of us that live and breathe in technology, it's hard enough. But for the population at large, there's not a chance, right? They're counting on folks like us to help generate trust how can they, you know, believe that a video is real, or that a source is authentic, or that a legal precedent that's cited in a court is in fact exists? I mean, these are like, this is crazy. How could you? But that's where we are. And so we don't really know yet how to assign trust for basic social and human interaction here. And so we don't want to get sort of so enamored of the cleverness, right? You know, give it six talking points. Hey, write me an article or a blog or a marketing thing, and it looks really cool. And it's a time saver. It's an amplifier of human behavior. But that's a lot different than having trust that we can count on, for example, in a legal sense. You know, that is the building a precedence to generate case law and so forth. So I think, yeah, Randy's point is a great one. There's not an easy answer there. And there's lots of good folks, you know, including us and other nonprofits and government agencies who are struggling with this whole issue of trust in AI and how do we address these social issues. So that's an area that's great to discuss. We're not solving it in 25 and maybe not in 26, but it's a great area for us to discuss.
Exactly. Yeah, we move on to Marcus Sachs, our Senior Vice President and Chief Engineer here at CIS. Now, if Randy had three, Marcus has four, so we're going to have to create a whole nother series on the review of this.
Sure.
But now he jumps into AI too, and obviously very popular theme. He's looking at the arms race. I think that's very, very interesting, attacker defender assessing the utility. Now, another element he does go into in his second prediction is about compliance and regulation. Very important, looking at AI and really compliance in that space. Goes to some of the governance elements that we discussed before. Really, again, looking at disinformation, intellectual property. So it has essences of some of the points that were made by Randy. But he also goes into, and we actually had a podcast, and I had the pleasure attending a session at RSA this year with Marcus and Representative Miss White from the Idaho National Laboratory, working on cyber-informed engineering and how that potentially has that embedded resiliency in critical systems. And he's, you know, obviously a big advocate of CIE and, you know, one of the main developers really of the techniques and principles in this space. So important to think about really where we see development. And, you know, we've talked about and assessed the shift left movement, right? Get security early rather than Sean coming in later and saying no, right? Let's get it in early and then we do it by design versus by exception or by change management, which never works, by the way. That another prediction I should have come up with, Tony, but I'll leave that one for next year.
Sure, absolutely. You're sure to be right on one of them, Sean. That's great.
At some point, I will be. He then goes into cloud security.
Yeah.
And I think it's important, again, he's looking at both velocity into the cloud. It's really a staple now of any modern real infrastructure. It is their multi-cloud strategies complying with regulations over, you know, certain integration, certain sovereignty of data in itself as well. And then another big one is zero trust. We saw and we talked in part one some of the predictions that Don Freely had made, our VP in IT. And Marcus builds on that with really assessing the no inherent trust, right? That's the zero trust principle. And then looking at that integration as well. So driving identity and access management, my own thought was zero trust being really brought in through a vector of identity and access management. That would be the initial element to start zero trust. You never finish it like security, Tony. It's, you know, this journey element that we've talked about before. And so he's identified that. So four very broad topics. I mean, and again, it takes a mind of Marcus to be able to conceptualize these all at once and be able to provide predictions, but very important. And again, all salient as we move into, you know, we're hitting the, you know, past the middle of 2025, we're seeing these come to fruition.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. You know, Marcus Sachs is, for the audience here, is one of those voices absolutely worth listening to, because I describe him as an engineer's engineer. you know, lots of people say things like software engineering or whatever, you know, security engineering, but Marcus is a real engineer. Yeah, that is, you know, from the classical sense of you know, civil engineering and you know, having a structure and accepted credentialing and so forth. But he's worked at, I mean, he's been on the front lines of cyber defense, you know, as a working guy in the military. He's been at the top of the U.S. government, you know, in terms of policy and strategy and everything in between. And he's always very thoughtful about things. I'll just mention this notion of compliance, a big one because it eats so much energy, right? And these are all well-intended. You know, how do we generate confidence that vendors are behaving in a responsible way, and or what does responsible even mean? It's important as social creatures that some of that machinery is managed for us, right? In some sense, that helps us manage risk without really understanding all the risks. And you know, the opportunities for AI, for better technology, I think are ripe within there. You know, kind of the worst case, if you sort of this go left to right, as you said, leftward, you know, the worst case would be every federal agency that has regulatory power, for example, independently develops some set of recommendations. And that's actually been quite true for a lot. In fact, a lot of it's still true. And all with the best of intentions. We're responsible for safety or confidence in this particular critical sector of the economy. With good intentions, we'll gather people, we'll write something down, and everyone's going to be tested against it, audited against it, inspected against it, report against it, something along those lines. Oh, but guess what? Nobody in this economy reports to only one regulator or one framework. They've got to deal with umpteen of them. So, one approach, we saw this in the DoD, you know, hey, everyone's got these different anti-malware, antivirus tools out there. Ah, now we don't have visibility. Let's make everybody buy the same tool. Well, guess how well that went, right? There's no one tool that solves the complexity of a DoD, you know, computing in the cloud, in the desert, you know, on ships and submarines. Yeah, there's just no one tool. So, okay, well, maybe we can demand compatibility. They'll all talk at a API level. Or, like we do with a lot of our stuff at CIS, we'll cross map. We'll develop a map between A, B, and C. And these are all useful but incomplete solutions to this complex problem. And so being able to say what you would like, right, conceptually, you want people to do things that are, I'll call it right in security, but be able to report to multiple parties their status with very little extra work. You want the work and the money and the time spent really on the analysis and the implementation and management of technology, not on the reporting. And yet we often get that backwards. And so I think part of Marcus's point is to think about, we need to think conceptually different about this, because technology will now allow us to do things. We don't have to build a one size fits all. We have the ability to kind of think of this problem more holistically and to say, you know, like CISA did with their critical functions, right? Moving from sectors to functions, because functions inevitably cross sectors. And so I want to be able to look, I'll say horizontally or in a different dimension at how security cascades across a whole line of a business activity or social activity. So I think there's, again, some thoughtful, and Marcus is one of the few I know that really has worked this, both in strategy, policy, as well as technology, frontline level. Zero trust, you know, not much to add there, Sean, you're neck deep in that, but you're exactly right. Zero trust does not mean no trust. It means you have to create, you know, give me 10 pounds of that zero trust thing. That sounds great. You have to create trust, build it from in every transaction, in every device, in every process. And you don't create it from whole cloth. You create it from something, right? Being able to identify the person, the process, the asset, being able to say, do I understand the security properties of these things I'm putting together? That's the role for things like CIS benchmarks, for example. In some sense, you're saying this piece of IT, if I configure it this way and I can verify that, it has a certain set of known security properties. Certain types of attacks will be blocked. Others, not sure. That might have to happen elsewhere in the system, but I know something there. So I can start to build trust from component parts. But at the end of the day, you're exactly right, which is I can't start from zero. Zero trust does not start from zero. It starts from some machinery that allows me to to have confidence that, you know, this is the person expected, these are the permissions they have, and you have to build an infrastructure for that. In some sense, it's more work, right? It's not less work, it's more work to gain more, right? To gain this ability then to manage information and access to it and, you know, do this in a much more comprehensive way. But there ain't no zero here. It's about work and the kind of work that we should have been doing all along in the industry. But, you know, the conceptual model, and, you know, you think of, you know, I know you behave this way, right? Zero trust is a sort of philosophical way to plan, architect, implement defense. It's not magic. It's not a tool. It's not a thing. It's all that, you know, plus the whole process that puts it in place and manages it. And at the end of the day, you don't get to make a declaration, you know, I have trust. You get to manage trust forevermore because things are going to change. New flaws will be found. Bad guys will behave differently. Some assets will become more critical under this circumstance. And all that has to be dynamically managed as part of your overall security program. And so, yeah, you start from the sort of the infrastructure known pieces is your only hope in doing something useful there. But yeah, great catch on Marcus, because again, I think he has lived a life that I think is unusually, you know, both accomplished, but also broad in scope, and has really seen just about all the industry has to show.
Absolutely. Well, we've got two more, and it comes from TJ Sayers, and he's looking at phishing as a service, like a cybersecurity market. And we talked the economics, and now we're seeing the market forces here by providing these elements as a service. We also we'll jump in with Valicia Stichetti as well, a cybersecurity engineer with the critical security controls team. And she's looking at AI across it. It's embedded in software. There are threats that are utilizing AI, and we're also going to use it for the good. So she's seen both sides again of the utility of AI, which is very interesting because in the space of critical security control, a consideration for AI is, I think, an absolute now. It needs to be an element that's consumed either from a governance perspective, but also that inventory piece. This is part of the hardware software landscape that we need to understand, integrate awareness so that we're better prepared for our flow diagramming. We're better prepared for data management. We're better prepared for access control, vulnerability assessment. This extends that, and in some cases, Tony, it requires us, again, the utility of AI, very, very potent, but there's the responsibility of integrating that into a controlled environment that we can understand, and in some cases, and you mentioned it before, the transparency today is lacking in some cases, and that does not help make salient risk-based decisions. It leads us into this, oh, we need AI. You're not moving fast enough. You're holding us back. And it's, well, I'm holding you back from a reason because it's, I'm holding you back from jumping into traffic. And there's a reason I'm trying to do that. I'm trying to help you. And again, we see the back and forth there and the governance requirements, but very interesting from both TJ and Valicia.
Yeah. So TJ has an excellent point. And it's, I think I put that in the category of the sort of the economics of attacks. That is, again, the attacker is looking for efficiency, looking for scale, you know, and again, studying capitalism is about studying bad guys. And I think that that's absolutely right. And we won't see that go away because bad guys are highly motivated and they have clear objectives, you know, whether it's financial or espionage or whatever. There's a certain clarity to offense that's very tempting, right? So you know, having worked in a place that had both an offensive mission and a defensive mission, a great respect for the people that, you know, work offense on behalf of the U.S. government. But hey, those guys know when they win. Defense, we're never sure when we win. And so, but this thinking about it in those terms is been part and parcel of the way CIS operates. So, and related to Felicia's point, right? We make a claim, critical security controls. We're not saying good ones, you know, nice ones, important ones. We're saying these are critical. And you have to have a basis for that. So anyone who says things like, and I often say this in talks, Sean, you know, anyone who says the term best practice or critical security controls, anyone makes a claim like that, you need to challenge them, including challenging us at CIS. And we're ready for you because we've given a lot of thought, right? We don't just, we have tried to move beyond the model, and Volitia has been right at the heart of it. You know, many of these traditional frameworks are, I put a bunch of smart people in a room, let them argue until they get tired of each other, and they write it all down, and it becomes, you know, the list of recommendations or top 10 list or whatever you happen to have. And we have over years now built more data-driven, transparent approaches, use of authoritative sources like the Verizon Data Breach Report, you know, working with CrowdStrike and Palo Alto and other companies to get a, if you're going to, if it's going to be critical, one approach to that is, what are bad guys actually doing? Not what they might do, what are they actually doing is an important part of your planning. And as you know better than certainly than I do, Sean, defense is inherently always a prioritization game. You never have the money you need, the people you need, the control of the environment that you want. Never. So you're always prioritizing and deciding, and there's no absolute meaning of critical, right? Critical in the environment that you're responsible for is different than any other enterprises. And so we're always trying to balance, what is it that everyone should be doing? You know, think of it as the mass market, you know, every attackers are out there. We don't, on any given day, we don't know whether we're an innocent victim, bystander, or a jump point in cyberspace, right? And so you have to kind of plan for a floor of activity that's just always happening. Bad things are always happening. So there's sort of a, I got to get to some foundation so I can build better defenses, so I can manage, have visibility, and so forth. At the same time, you have to worry about, yeah, but some things at CIS are more important than others. Some data is more sensitive than others. Some partners, you know, the way we interact them is more important to our outcome or our mission than others. And so now I got to factor that into my defensive strategy also. Not all things. I had a debate one time with a senior military officer, and they made the point that she said, the problem with cyber defense and DoD is we've operated under a flawed assumption that everything should be protected. Therefore, we don't protect important things. And I said, sorry, ma'am, I think you have it backwards. Now, everything needs to be protected, but not everything needs to be protected at the same level. Many things that, and Sean, how many times have you seen this, right? Things that an enterprise CISO or whoever decides, that's not critical, turns out to be the perfect attack vector. It's the way the bad guy gets in. If you do a risk assessment and you say, this 60% of my enterprise is not critical, there's only thing, one thing I know for sure. Someday in the future, you will be proven wrong. In other words, you can't ignore parts just of your enterprise. You have to say, I have to defend everything. Not equally, though, because I have to prioritize. I have to understand. But no, everything deserves some level of protection. Some things deserve a whole lot more because our business depends upon it. Now, being able to sort that out, have a plan, make choices. And so, you know, Volitia's point, so how does new technology, how does AI help us do that? And do it in a dynamic way, right? Because none of these are going to be static. That's the nature of business today. Partners will come and go. And in fact, you manage all our third-party relationships, or they come through you, right? I don't want to limit my suppliers. I want to have a broad range of suppliers. And if this one isn't up to snuff, I want to be able to quickly switch at low cost to somebody else, which means I'm constantly renegotiating trust and access, which means I have to have a lot of stuff figured out ahead of time, so that I can, you know, take advantage of a rich, large supplier base. That's good business for us. But you're not going to get there without, you know, again, sort of having machinery in place that says, I know it's important. When I enter into a transaction with a supplier, they need this data, this level of control, this access to information, but only that. And it's only for this purpose, for this period of time, right? Trust has gone, I grew up in a world of trust is binary. You're either have a security clearance or you don't. You're a trusted supplier to the DoD or you're not. That's all gone, right? Everything is dynamically renegotiated all the time, constantly. And again, if you haven't planned for that, you don't have a prayer of implementing that. So I wandered a bit here, but you know, the exciting thing is, you know, Volitia has been right at the heart of this. And in fact, I know there's a discussion right now about what does the community defense model version 3 look like. How do we build even more automation, better mappings to authoritative sources, allow people to take our work, our recommendations, our controls, and our benchmarks, implement them, but also fine-tune them for their particular situation, right? Without them having to grunt through, you know, reams and reams and reams of complex data. I think there's some really exciting possibilities that we'll be discussing and I hope rolling out before too long.
Absolutely. No, 100%, Tony. And the I just whenever anybody says best practice, I say, look, we're past practice. We're at Carnegie Hall. We're on stage. The drummer's got one drumstick. The guitar's missing two strings. The bass has no amp. We're going to have to play anyway. You're never going to have everything that you need in order to do this. And we're always
well said. Well said as a CISO for a security company. Well done.
Wonderful. Well, Tony, we got through all 12. Thank you very much. Really appreciate
it. Thank you, Sean. Thank you for leading us through that. And we appreciate the work of all the staff at CIS who contributed ideas. You know, as a small but mighty nonprofit, right? These are the kind of discussions that are just part of our strategic thinking. And you know, we're blessed with the resources of a great team, great partners, and the ability to and sort of flexibility and enough in our business model to say, you know, constantly ask ourselves what are the important problems that need to be solved and that we can make a unique contribution to, right? So this is just part of the conversation that's pretty regular here for us at the Center for Internet Security.
No question. Yes. No, again, thank you to everyone who contributed. And again, thank you to our audience. It's a longer episode, but well worth it. I'm sure you would agree. Make sure to subscribe in all the usual ways, your preferred podcast provider. Catch us on YouTube at The CI Security for episodes like this and much, much more. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the podcast today.
The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS.
Tune in on Wednesdays for a new episode. And in the meantime, visit our website at cisecurity.org.
Together, we'll continue our efforts of creating confidence in the connected world.